go.
1859.
Hi there, this is Michael Hurst.
And Rick Moody.
Bringing you another episode of 1859, the podcast.
That's exactly 1 second shorter than 19 minutes.
This is true. And we have special guest with us today. Who do we have?
To my right, the talented and charming Claudia Gonson, and to your left, the talented and charming Eric Saatchi.
Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
All right, and today's theme we have chosen is Neighbors.
Who chose this theme, anyway?
You said that I chose it, but I'm pretty sure you chose it.
I don't remember choosing it.
I'm sure we could go back through emails and figure this out, but...
Well, the more important question is, do you have a good neighbor story?
By all means. Doesn't everybody have a good neighbor story? Maybe not.
I hope so, or we're going to be wasting 18 minutes and 59 seconds.
It wouldn't be the first time. Before I moved to New York, I lived in Richmond, Virginia, and owned a house. I was a homeowner. Very happy to have sold my house and now just rent here. But when I was living in Richmond, I kind of had a horrible neighbor sandwich situation, meaning that on either side of my house in Richmond, I had kind of crazy neighbors. On one side was this guy named Paul Draculich. That was his actual last name.
Is he from Transylvania?
Well, he may as well have been. But and the funny thing is his brother, whose name I can't remember, I'll probably get in trouble for this, is one of the main guys in the band Guar. A Richmond band.
Oh, no way, man. You didn't say you were going to tell your story about Guar.
It's not a Guar story. I'm just saying my neighbor was the brother of one of the guys in Guar. Draculich. I'm sure you can find it somewhere.
Wait, do you guys have Guar-related stories? Because I just don't. Guar doesn't even figure in my story at all.
Nor does it need to.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
So anyway, Draculich was on one side, and he... He liked to indulge in the beverages, and also we didn't have the best relationship. He was a little annoyed with the noise I would create for my recording studio, but we avoided each other, and I watched him. I could see him through my window in his window, drinking Miller Genuine Drafts nightly. But the real problem was the other side. I had a neighbor on the other side named Earl, who was.
Wait a second, isn't that your father's
yes,
name?
Yes, but this was not my father.
Can you just pronounce for us how you say your father's name?
Earl. My dad's going to hear this.
Yeah, that's good.
Earl, he was, as they say down south, was touched. He wore a hospital gown around as his clothing, and not because he was hospitalized, he just liked the way it felt. Quite often you'd see him walking down the street with the back untied and that 60-year-old white buttocks. Heine sounds small. It wasn't a Heine. It was a...
A hugey,
yes. But he was kind of nuts. He would actually leave me little gifts, little tokens in front of the house. And once in a while he found my phone number and started calling me and leaving these crazy messages and, "Hi, Michael, it's Earl. I was just wondering what you're doing in this circus of a world that we live in." Like, he would just say creepy things and leave little... He actually left a whole TV tray of books and random gifts in front of my house one time. And, you know, that was kind of the crazy thing. But the ultimate crazy thing happened on one particular night. While making dinner, my doorbell rang, and I walked over to the door. I wonder who's ringing my doorbell, and there's Earl, and I see him through the window, and I didn't dare just open the door. I just kind of was like, "Hi, Earl," and then I realized he looked like his shoulders were kind of exposed, so I looked a little, lifted my neck up, and I was like, "Earl, are you all right?" He's like, I don't know, Michael. I'm here at your house, and I don't have any clothes on."
Did you let him in?
No, hell no. No way. I was like, "Earl, I think you should probably go home. You don't really want to go to people's houses naked and ring the doorbell." And he was like, but Michael, I'm naked. You know, I was like, "Earl, you should go home. I'm going to call the police if you don't go home." He's like, "Why would you call the police?" And kind of walked away from my door. And at that point, I walked back into the house and I was with Kelly, and I was like, my girlfriend Kelly, and I was like, and she's like biting her nails, hiding around the corner, peeking, like, oh my God, did that really just happen? And we kind of, you know, we went into one of the bedrooms with the lights off so we could see through the window without them looking, him looking in. And sure enough, he went to the next house, to Draculich's house, rang Draculich's doorbell. Draculich lets him in, and the next thing I see is Earl sitting on Draculich's couch, naked, drinking PBRs. And that's my neighbor's story.
Wow, that's
excellent.
Awesome.
Yeah,
thank you. I thought he was going to drain him of his blood.
Yeah, Draculich is going to suck all his blood.
What's your story, Rick?
Wait, hang on.
Wait for it.
Wait, hang on. This is really going to be an anti-climax now.
1859.
My story concerns when I lived in San Francisco, California, which was in the year after I graduated from undergraduate school. I decided to get as far away from my parents as I could get. So I moved to San Francisco with, among other people, the writer who went on to become Jeffrey Eugenides, author of Virgin Suicides in Middlesex. Yeah, and his friend Mark. So we got this apartment on Haight Street, Lower Haight Street, you know, nearby Haight-Ashbury, or 10 blocks or so from there. And at that time, it was a pretty dingy neighborhood still. It had, in fact, on our intersection, 3 out of the 4 corners had liquor stores. And you know, we were sort of living there on the cheap and had no furniture. I slept on a door for about 4 months before I could afford to get a futon. Yeah, door that was stretched out on cinder blocks before I could get a mattress. And after a while, we met our downstairs neighbors, one of whom was this tall, extremely good-looking gay man, kind of... I guess he was sort of a Brad Pitt kind of looking guy, really suave and, you know, like an operator sort of. And he kept coming up to our apartment and smoking pot with Mark, my third roommate. And we got kind of friendly with him. And then we realized that there was a guy downstairs who was ostensibly the boyfriend of this guy, a little tiny guy with a big, huge, like, Raleigh fingers, handlebar mustache kind of thing. And apparently the Brad Pitt guy was coming upstairs to get away from the little guy because the little guy was really clingy and sort of they weren't getting along too well. And then once we got that part sussed out, we realized that the gigantic, like, 300-pound woman who was there was also in a relationship with the two guys. So it was actually a genuine... attempt to have a sort of a ménage à trois marriage thing, you know? And I guess she was a lesbian. I think she was a lesbian. They were gay. But the fact of the matter is that they didn't get along very well. And periodically we would hear, you know, just these incredible knockdown, drag out fights coming from the apartment downstairs. Like, you know, you couldn't believe how loud some of this stuff would be. It would just...
Rick Moody prepared with sound effects.
So anyway, we would actually hear, like, the body would hit the far wall of the apartment, and then there'd be a silence, and then there'd be like, oh, oh, oh. It was always the guys, I think, going at it, and then the, you know, the woman soprano sailing above the other voices saying, motherfucker, get out of here. And it wasn't long sort of into all this that we realized that actually the woman was pregnant. Ooh. And they were having a child. And so soon they had this child, and there were the three of them with the child. Nice. And this really heinous, awful situation going on. I moved out. I went back to New York. Mark moved out. Jeff kept the apartment. And periodically I would write to him and I would say, you know, how's it going with the people downstairs? You know, he would say, still horrible or whatever. And then a couple of months later, I was in New York, and Jeff told me that the entire bunch of them were appearing on, I believe it was Merv Griffin, but it might have been like Montel or something like that. But anyway, so all three of them were on there, like the hair combed, you know, awesome. Everything perfect as the pinup family for the new, you know, post-nuclear family in American civilization. Like, three people and a baby, we can make it work, you know, smiling, well-behaved, charming.
That seems like it should have been Jerry Springer.
I think it was before Jerry Springer, 1984. Anyway, that's my story.
Awesome.
Where are they now?
Where are they now? Good question.
We need a sequel on that one.
1859. So, Eric.
Yes.
You got a good neighbor story?
I do. As I'm thinking about it, though, I don't know if I'm the neighbor or if my neighbor is the neighbor. I don't know who's the bad neighbor. It's a little altercation I had with a neighbor when I was living in Burlington, Vermont, many years ago. Sort of a suburban section of Burlington, Vermont. So houses were not touching as they do here in New York. They were kind of, you know, you have a little yard and a little fence around every house. And I lived with a roommate, Dave, who's a good friend, and he lives in Brooklyn now. And we shared this house, and he's a tall guy. He's about 6'8". Very wow. big. His whole family's that big. It's really amazing going to the movies with him. All the kids protest because this huge family walks in. It's all, you know, 6.5+ feet tall.
No one would
want
to sit behind that family.
Exactly. Exactly. So he had this little car, and you know, he drove it all the time. And but he never had any money, so he never put gas in it. So he'd always leave this note for himself on the dashboard saying, fill it up with gas, to remind him to put gas in first thing in the morning. So one day he goes out to this car and gets in, and the seat is pushed all the way forward, and the car is full of gas, and his alarm bell is kind of triggered, saying, well, what's going on? You know, maybe Eric took the car and put gas in it. But then he looks over to the right and sees like some Butterfinger candy wrappers on the seat.
That's always the sign, a Butterfinger candy wrapper. If it had been like, you know, like Snickers.
Yeah, it would have been fine. And I was you know, I could have. In the tape deck was a cassette of Two Live Crew, which.
Another sign.
Another sign. Dave was pretty adamant DC hardcore person. And, you know, here was this Two Live Crew tape. Although he was psyched, but, you know, someone's been in my car, basically, is what he came up to. And so he sort of let it slide. He mentioned it to me, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. He thought, oh, maybe a friend borrowed it or something odd like that. I mean, basically, you know, we were thinking something was going on, but we weren't quite sure what yet. So a couple of days later, he goes out to get into his car in the morning, and in the grill, embedded in the grill, is like almost the contents of an entire cornfield. There's corn stalks sticking out in all kinds of directions. So at this point, he realized someone's taking the car regularly and bringing it back in the same place.
And driving it through cornfields.
Driving it through cornfields.
Like, you know, the guy could have been polite and just, you know, driven it through a mall parking lot.
Yeah. So, so we started to figure out, well, what are we going to do? And at this point, Dave realized, oh, I'd left a key in the car, so he must have found a key under the mat that I had a spare key. And so someone in the neighborhood is taking this car and getting a little more confident with it every time they take it. And, you know, we were young enough to be completely incensed by this. I mean, now when I think about it, I'm like, go, man, go. That was cool. But at the time, we were completely incensed by it. So we put the car in our garage, which was not attached to the house. So we thought that would at least deter it a little bit from happening again. And we put it in the garage, and I actually was so riveted about this that I slept in the kitchen, which was the closest room to the garage, actually thinking I could hear the car start and I would jump out and catch
Where
this
were the
person.
Keys? Was this person hot-wiring it, or
well,
the keys in the car?
The keys were... I sort of mumbled across it that the keys, he had left a spare key in the car at one point. So that's what he's thinking. The door was always unlocked because this was Burlington. And right. So basically, I fell asleep in the kitchen, the car was gone again because I put a little stone in front of the door to see if it was moved. That was my only other concern. I put a stone in front of the, and it was used again. So we were just livid at this point. So I took, we had this old fishing pole in our basement, and I took it and I tied it to the wheel of the fishing lure and like walked all the way across my lawn, like backing up, letting out fishing line, and brought it in through the kitchen, through the dining room, and set it on the couch by the TV and just proceeded to watch TV. And so they were talking, we were laughing, and we were watching that very night. We were watching David Letterman, even when David Letterman was on a little later and at this time, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, the fishing pole starts going. It was like, oh! I was like kind of laughing, but also excited and also kind of angry. And I was holding it and pulling it back. And finally, you know, snap, the line snapped. And I didn't know what to do, you know, like, oh. And so I ran out into the street. And what he had done is he was really daring at this point, because we were obviously awake watching TV. He had pulled the car out and he was coming back to the garage to close the door in case we checked. And so I ran out in the street and I stopped, and then there was my neighbor stopped, and we were facing each other, and I was like immediately like, he's like 20 or so, you know, what are we gonna do? And so I ran in to call the cops. I didn't, and he disappeared, I guess. So I ran in. I don't know why I did this. I mean, now I probably, I don't know. It was that moment. And you know, all the days that I had seen this kid playing on the street, or not playing, or just walking around the street, it all came together and I knew who he was. And so I went in and I called the cops. They came over eventually. The car stayed there. He disappeared. He ran off. And the cop just sort of in Vermont just sort of said, oh, well, you know, bet you you better take off the distributor or something like that, because I don't know, he's got a key, he'll just take it again. And I went, okay. Great. So my solution was to like kind of let the kid know that I knew who he was. So it was pouring rain actually at this time already. It got darker and darker this night. I went over to where his house was, and he was, I know, hiding in his house. And I stood in the rain, like with my arms on my hips, just staring at what I thought was his bedroom window for like an hour, you know, wow, thinking that would say, oh, I know who you are.
But what about locking the door?
Well, he had a key to the car. Locking the garage door, we could have done, but that would have been sensible. You know, in the years since, I've thought of like, oh, I could have set up all kinds of traps, paint cans that would have woken me up, or...
But that was it. He never...
He never did it again. I knew it was, too, because I followed... I followed him once, days later, and honked my horn. He didn't turn around. Well, good one. Wow, it's good to get it off my chest. I've been holding that in for so many years.
That's a good story.
Finally. Well,
Claudia Gonson, what's your neighbor story?
I'm surprised I'm the only one of the four of us New Yorkers who's going to talk about my experience in the East Village, which I assumed all of us were going to talk about, you know, being stuck in tenement buildings in the East Village of New York, or I guess anywhere in New York. Yes. Actually... That was the Spanish family on the right side, but the on the left and up and down and. No. I only had one that was shouting. I had a lot of fucking. I actually can say this because I'm on a blog, which is very exciting, instead of, you know, on actual radio. It was sort of like this chorus of groans.
You can also say making love.
There's like, well, these people were not making love. This was like love. Pounding.